Hello everyone, Stan Gill here. Welcome to the Hollywood South Blacklist. This is show number 8 and was originally recorded on Friday, October 26, 2012. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, send us an email to podcast@thehollywoodsouthblog.com. And be sure to stop by the website to take a look around. Enjoy. Well, hello everybody, Stan Gill here, and this is the Hollywood South Blacklist, where we discuss all things Hollywood South, a filmmaker's paradise. On the show, we'll have listener email as usual. We'll talk about the indie film scene. We'll also talk about the U.S. Copyright Office renewing the fair use exemption to the DMCA. If you're a documentary filmmaker, that will be of news to you. We'll talk about the pitch process for reality TV. And as always, I'll have my book and software recommendation. So let's start off with listener email. Mike W. writes, I am interested in pitching a show or documentary idea here in Louisiana. It could be anywhere in the United States. So I'm going to coach this, even though it's Hollywood South. Let's talk about the entire United States because of the distributors. But I'm going to answer that a little bit later on. The first thing I'm going to talk about is U.S. Copyright Office renewing the fair use exemption to the DMCA. The Digital Millennium Copyright Act, or DMCA for shorthand, was passed on October 12, 1998 by unanimous vote in the United States Senate and later signed into law by then-President Bill Clinton on October 28, 1998. It amended Title 17 of the United States Code. Essentially, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act was supposed to criminalize production, or it does, and dissemination of technology and devices and intellectual property, DVDs, which you commonly see, online video, things of that sort. Now, flash forward, you hear years ago about a teenage kid overseas who had busted the DVD encryption code, and technically he really didn't do anything fantastic other than look into a disc because a manufacturer had actually left the back door open for the encryption keys, if you will, because DVDs are encrypted to try to prevent copying of those discs, piracy. Now, essentially, that is the number one threat to quote-unquote Hollywood is piracy. And until you've had your intellectual property, your movie, your script stolen from you, you're generally going to be of the school of thought that, okay, piracy. You know, I watch movies online. Yeah, I get them P2P. I go on BitTorrents and get them. And you try to watch something that you can't get access to. I'm not saying that's right because you're essentially stealing money from somebody else. If your argument is, well, the studios make enough money and they've got millions of dollars, what's this one going to do? Well, I tell you, I have several friends that did small films, short films, feature films, couldn't get distributors, busted their butts for years, finally got a distributor, and within about 3 months, the next thing they know is someone calls them up and says, hey, dude, guess what? I just saw your film on a peer-to-peer sharing site, a BitTorrent site, and they log on, go into that site, and they download and look at it, and they're literally just crushed. I have this one friend I believe I spoke about in another podcast that is absolutely crushed by the fact that their work that they had been working on for several years has been pirated. When you talk about it from a producer standpoint, an independent producer standpoint, a legal standpoint, it's intellectual property. It's something that you've created with screenwriters, with actors, with crew talent, etc. I read this article titled U.S. Renews Fair Use Exemption for DVDs Online Video by Kevin Ritchie in realscreen.com. He writes, the U.S. Copyright Office has renewed an exemption to the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA, that allows documentary filmmakers to rip footage from DVDs and streaming video to use excerpts of their work. I get this question a tremendous amount of time, and I see it a tremendous amount. People want to rip video from YouTube, and they say, well, it's on YouTube, it's publicly being broadcast, so that means I can take it. That technically is not true. It's very rare instances where you can actually take that video. down off of YouTube, copy it off of YouTube, and use it in your own works. I'm going to put this argument for fair use aside, because documentary filmmakers, fair use is a tool that they use in their creation of their intellectual property, their documentaries. So I'm going to put that aside just for a second. I get this question about, well, why can't I just download it off of YouTube and use it there? It must be free because it's up there. And you see that all the time. How many times have you watched a video on YouTube? In the comments section, it says, no copyright infringement intended. Your intent doesn't matter. You've already infringed the copyright by publishing it up there. I can't remember what the stat was for YouTube, but it was something like every hour there's 24 hours of video that goes up on YouTube. Now, that seems a little bit low. It's probably a little bit higher. Maybe it's every 60 seconds, 24 hours of video gets loaded up on YouTube from all over the world. Now, granted, it's everything from cat videos to dog videos to stuff you would never even watch. It just aggregates tons and tons and tons of video. The thing is all the studios have their own third-party vendors and their own in-house personnel that use special software programs that scan, scrape YouTube and other sites looking for their intellectual property. So if you've created Avatar and for some reason a scene or two or something gets put up on YouTube, eventually, sooner or later, it's going to get knocked down. A lot of times, it will get knocked down automatically before it even gets published up onto the site. Let's say you're somebody who is uploading a scene from Avatar. And generally speaking, to be honest with you, most of these that I see are teenagers that see a scene from some movie that they like, and so they'll upload it to YouTube and then put this little quote-unquote disclaimer below it saying no copyright infringement intended. That doesn't protect you from getting sued. But generally speaking, the way the law works right now is that YouTube has a safe harbor, if you will, where if they provide a takedown notice procedure, then the copyright holder, the intellectual property holder, in this case Avatar, the property holders, the intellectual property holders of Avatar from the studios to James Cameron, his Lightstorm Entertainment, they will take down, and the distributors, they will take down that video sometimes before it even gets published. Because if you've ever uploaded video to YouTube, you upload it and it takes a while for the computers to crunch it, get it into their format and get it up onto the site. And sometimes it gets knocked down before it's even put up there. The thing is that the DMCA has, in my opinion, it was bad law to begin with. It should have never been signed into law. However, it's sort of, I hate to use this term, but it sort of brought the United States in line with the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, however way you want to pronounce it, essentially says, okay, if we're going to get on this piracy bandwagon, then what we're going to do is we're going to hold ourselves up to the same laws and rules that we have or require other countries to do the same. If you've ever watched a movie and you've stayed till the end of the credits, or you're watching it on a DVD, you've looked at the end of the credits, you'll say, you know, copyright 20th Century Fox this year for the purposes of authorship, 20th Century Fox is the author. This copyright adheres to the Berne Convention. Things like that. Essentially what it's saying is that the entire globe of Earth, we're trying to come together and say, if a movie is produced anywhere, you're claiming authorship, then this stamp, if you will, on the movie says who owns it and who's the author of it. So if someone gets sued later on, or FBI gets involved, or other countries, police, law enforcement entities get involved to try to crack down on piracy, then they have a legal stance to begin with. Essentially, the DMCA, which was signed into law in 1998, gave tools to filmmakers and essentially the studios so that they have laws on the books now that you can't rip their DVDs. Because DVD came about in 1997. It was a new technology. It was wild. The legal size of every studio, even the smaller studios and the smaller independent filmmakers, they were just petrified that they put this digital pristine copy on a disc that can play and it was going to get ripped. And the moment they shipped those discs out, and sometimes even before then, because there was piracy in the distribution chain before it even made it to the public, you know, somebody snagged a disc here, it got out into the open market, and next thing you know is a bazillion copies were made and it's on a BitTorrent. Well, flash forward almost 14 years since that law is written and things have changed. So this DMCA exemption for ripping DVDs, it used to be the way the law originally stood. If you created a feature film and you put it on a DVD and you were distributing it across the world, United States or whatever, and then you decided to take that same DVD and rip it yourself to use it for something, or you told somebody, hey, yeah, here's my DVD, you just rip it and you can have that footage, technically they were breaking the law. How are they going to get busted? Are you going to turn around and sue them? Are you going to go to the FBI and say, hey, this person's ripping my DVD? No, that's how bad the law was written. So they've made these exemptions over the year. The exemption we're talking about was first granted in 2010, and it allows, quote, the circumvention of motion pictures contained on DVDs and delivered through online services, which are popular now, to permit the use of short portions for purposes of criticism and comment and non-commercial videos. That's the key, non-commercial videos, documentary films, documentary filmmakers, non-fiction multimedia ebooks offering film analysis, and for certain educational uses by college and university faculty and students and kindergarten through 12th grade educators, end quote. If you were in a film criticism class, your instructor, your professor could bring in a DVD and you could sit there and still frame and watch certain movies and critique them. When I went to film school, we didn't have that at all. In fact, barely you could get anything on VHS. Most of the time, we actually had to watch it on projected film, believe it or not. And that's how we critiqued it. And VHS came along, and we saw movies on that. It's a lot easier today. You can get it video on demand, and you can get a DVD. You can go rent a DVD and do your own critique. In the college university atmosphere, technically you were breaking the law by showing it. Now, this exemption allows the professors to do that. So let's steer this boat around to documentary films. A lot of the times, documentary filmmakers will spend an inordinate amount of time searching and hunting down footage and clips for whatever their message happens to be. So let's say, for instance, they're doing a documentary on Katrina and its effect on the school system in New Orleans and the surrounding areas. And there were, let's say, programs that were produced by other organizations that were put on DVD, and you wanted clips from there. Those organizations, those news organizations, generally speaking, have their own libraries, and you call them up and you say, yeah, I'm looking for some footage on Katrina or whatever. Now, with the internet, you can actually go online and watch little clip videos. You sign up, you get an account with them. You sign up and you log in and see these little clips of videos and say, yeah, that's something that I want to use. That's a clip that I'd like to use. And you pay for them to make a copy of that and send it to you, or sometimes you can actually download it right from the website. And the key is, with the exemption, it allows you to rip, that's the cool kids term, rip the footage from the DVD and use that on your documentary. It doesn't give you a blanket license where you can turn around and just take everything that you want off that DVD and use it any way you want to. You have to be able to provide some kind of criticism or comment. And if you're a documentary filmmaker, generally speaking, that's what you're doing. You're providing a documentary based on a subject. For instance, the one example I use, say schools post-Katrina, and you're using somebody's work or film or whatever to talk about a specific instance, or someone in there is interviewed and gives a quote, but you know that quote is wrong, or the person didn't say it right, or the person did say it right and nobody picked up on it, whatever it happens to be, you can use that clip. I'm not saying, and the law doesn't say, oh, you get free rein, you can use that clip and nobody can touch you, because you're still going to get sued if somebody finds out if that clip is in your documentary or your nonfiction multimedia ebook. The reason is because someone created that, whether it's a news organization, they paid for it, they paid for the crews, they paid for everything to be done, the cameras, the equipment, to have that produced, and that's how they make their bread and butter. Later on, they sell those clips out of a library, and you say, no, but I can't. I can use this because the DMCA gives me an exemption for fair use. I'm not saying that fair use is a bad thing. I hear this all the time in my little documentary circles, is that fair use to them is like their shield for everything, that they can, it doesn't matter, they can use anything that they want and they can just hold up the shield of fair use. And I remember a lawyer telling me one time, fair use only gives you the right to hire an attorney. And that's right, because if someone wants to sue you, they're going to turn around and sue you and say, that's my clip. You actually have to go to court, and this isn't federal court. This isn't your little muni court around the corner, around the bend, where, you know, Buford T. Justice is the judge, and you know him or his grandkids from school, and you can wink, wink, you know, hey, judge, how you doing today, kind of thing. You'll go to federal court, and they will drag you through there, and guess what? If they lose, they lose, but you've got to hire an attorney to represent you to go to federal court, because federal court is pretty damn expensive. You think traffic court's expensive? Wait till you go to federal court trying to stave off a fair use lawsuit. This exemption went into effect of October 28th of this year, and it lasts until 2015. However, here's one key exemption to the exemption, or exclusion to the exemption, however way you want to put it. The Register of Copyrights in the Library of Congress, okay, the evil men behind the green curtain, they've said, okay, well, you can have this exemption for DVDs, but not Blu-ray. No way, you can't touch the Blu-ray, the pristine quality of Blu-ray. If you're gonna use this for your documentary, we want you to use crappy DVD quality, standard definition quality, and not Blu-ray quality. No, not Blu-ray quality for sure. If you're a documentary filmmaker and you're putting together a documentary, and a lot of times you're putting together a documentary over several years, let's put it that way, you want to use these clips and these reels, and you're going to find a distributor. Let's say you luck out and you find a documentary distributor, or you get it on Netflix. You get it on HBO or some other cable outlet, you strike a deal. First thing they're going to ask you for is chain of title. Your chain of title is going to be this big giant binder or multiple binders, and it will list every single piece of paper, contract, location release, personal release, video release that you have for the people that you interviewed, for every clip, every still image that you use, everything. And somebody's going to sit down, go through that binder, and go frame by frame through your documentary, and they're going to come across that one little clip, and they're going to say, well, wait a second, it says here that you have this clip of this school in New Orleans post-Katrina, and they're interviewing somebody, and it says that you ripped this from a DVD. Where was the DVD? Who was it? And then they look into it. They may turn around and say, we don't think that's a good shot. We don't want to get sued over that, so you're going to have to replace it. So now you've agonized all this time. You've taken a clip off a DVD. You've ripped it off a DVD and say, no. This is fair use. I can use this. And they'll say, well, not if we're distributing your project. As a documentary filmmaker, yes, you can use this exemption, and you can legally use the exemption to the DMCA to rip from DVDs clips that you want to use in your documentary. But at the end of the day, it's the distributor who's going to make the final decision. Let's say, for instance, you don't find a distributor and you put it on your website, or you put it up on YouTube. Well, if you put it up on YouTube, the entire globe's going to find it. You put it up on your website, same thing, entire globe is going to find it. You're going to write this whole nice article and try to get someone to review your documentary, and they're going to talk about something. And sooner or later, someone's going to stumble across it. The software algorithms and software programs that the copyright holders have, and mainly they're the big studios and networks, they just troll the internet looking for stuff like that, and all of a sudden a flag pops up, and you know, somebody sitting behind a computer goes to the website and looks at it and says, I don't know why, but the program says on this site is something to do with Katrina, post-Katrina schools and some interviews, and next thing you know, well, wait a second, is that a clip from something we did? Essentially, you're going to get a letter from the copyright holder saying, you've got to take it down. You may have a perfectly valid defense, and maybe be even able to go into federal court and defend it yourself, or when I say yourself, with an attorney, and say, hey, this is fair use, and they lose. But you've just gone through this whole mess, and that's a landmine that documentary filmmakers step on every once in a while, and sometimes it's fatal, and sometimes it's not. It's just a decision that you're going to have to use when you're putting together these projects. If you're a documentary filmmaker that's ever received a cease and desist letter from a major studio or network that says you need to take this down, they'll write all those legalese. Just that letter alone sometimes makes you mess your britches to the point where you say, nah, I'm just going to use something else. It just depends. So to round it out, the Copyright Office extended this extension, so if you're a documentary filmmaker in this realm, you can do it in other realms too, but a documentary filmmaker and you have DVDs that you want to rip for certain scenes, use exactly what you need to get your point across. Don't overuse and don't underuse. And then who makes that decision? Well, at the end of the day, if you get sued, it's going to be a judge or jury that is going to make that decision. Or the decision gets made for you and the distributor says, no, we're not going to distribute your project with that clip in there. The life of a documentary filmmaker. Going back to our listener email, Mike W. wrote, I am interested in pitching a show or documentary idea here in Louisiana. What should I do? So, Mike, you've come to the right place. I'm going to tell you, you absolutely positively have no chance of getting your pitch seen by anybody other than your friends and family. Boy, did I just rain on his parade. Technically speaking, that's not true. As a general rule, it practically is. And here's the reason why. I don't know how many reality series that have come across my desk when I worked for certain companies, companies that we were hired by production companies to put together a pitch reel. That pitch reel was pitch book would be used to pitch a reality TV show to some network. And I can't tell you the amount of shows that I've done because I've lost count. I can't tell you the amount of ideas that I've had clients talk to me and my companies about. I can't tell you the amount of pitch reels that I've seen. Imagine sitting on YouTube for 10 hours a day. Okay, imagine you're a 13-year-old kid sitting on YouTube for 12 hours a day, and all you do is watch video after video after video after video after video. But you don't get to select the videos that you want to watch. You have to watch whatever is put in front of you. The reason I use that as an example is because that can give you an idea of how it can make your eyes glaze over. Well, the companies I work for, pretty professional, were given ideas. I would say 90% of them sucked. You look at it, and it's the client, and you say, your pitch to them is, we can take that idea, your sucky idea, and we can try to produce a pitch reel, or let me rephrase that, we can produce a pitch reel and pitch deck for you, pitch book, and you can use that to go in and pitch your show. If you don't get the show, it's not our fault. It's whatever it happens to be that you sign off on. I don't know how many shows that I've worked on where we knew when we took the project and we looked at it, we said, they'll never pick this up. Here's generally how the process works. So let's say Mike was a client of mine in my company, and he came in and says, I have an idea and I want to pitch it to a network. I want to know how to go about doing it. Well, Mike, you've come to the right place. We can produce a pitch reel and pitch deck for you, a pitch book. What's the word I'm looking for? It's sort of a graphic novel, which is a fancy term for comic book that you hand the network. They've got the short video, which is probably anywhere from 4 to 6 minutes, depending on the project. And those aren't hard and fast rules. I've seen pitches 8-9 minutes long. I've seen pitches that were 3.5 minutes long. When I say pitches, I mean video wise. And then it's up to you to go to the network to see, or a production company, to see if you can get the thing picked up. Now, let me explain how that process works. It's sort of like building a house. Somebody comes up to you and says, hey, Stan, how do you build a house? The first thing I'm going to ask you is, how many bedrooms do you want? Is it going to be a single story? Is it going to be two stories? Is it a garaged house? Is it a detached garage? Does it have a pool? All these different types of things come into play. Then you sit down and you try to budget and figure out how much would it take. It also depends on where you build in the United States. Are you going to build that house in Los Angeles? Are you going to build that house in New Orleans? Two different price structures there. So you're bringing in a pitch as a client, or let's say you're an independent producer. Mike wants to, let's call him an independent producer. I don't know his skill level. I don't even know if he's a writer or just some guy walking down the street and says, hey, I have this idea. And the thing about ideas is that they get stolen all the time. Ideas are not copyrightable. You can't say that I have an idea for a reality TV show and ABC stole it, or NBC stole it, or this company stole it, because an idea is not copyrightable, period. I don't know how many times I've had people say, I've got this idea and the idea was stolen from me. Well, the aliens came down and put a probe in your ears and sucked it out of your brain and stole it, or you told somebody about it because you just thought it was the greatest idea in the world, and the next thing you know, a year later, somebody used that idea for whatever show. It doesn't matter. You can turn around and sue them all you want. You're going to lose, and then you're going to end up being countersued. It happens all the time. You stole my idea. We're pitching for a reality series here. Mike has an idea, and he wants to pitch it for a reality series. Now, he said in Louisiana, I don't know if it's a local cooking show for a specific city, let's say Baton Rouge, I don't know, or if it's an idea of like swamp people who are British, I don't know. It's not going to be pitched in Louisiana. It's going to be pitched at the networks, probably in New York or in Los Angeles, one of the two ways. Now, here's the thing, and I'm talking very broad picture, going back to my house analogy, because there's so many different facets to building that house, to building that pitch. There were some recent interviews with a bunch of development executives at a seminar that I had attended, and I sort of cobbled together all their ideas and the things that they spoke about. And one development executive said, you never know when a hit idea is going to cross your desk. So they want to see everything. But going back to my analogy of a 17-year-old, 13-year-old, 12-year-old kid or whatever, teenager watching 12 hours worth of YouTube videos, your eyes will glaze over. And sometimes within 30 seconds of watching a pitch reel, you're going to know whether or not you even care about that product or not. And there's so many levels you have to go through. It's not like you pick up the phone and you say, hey, let's call Bob at NBC because Bob is the development executive over there for reality TV series. You luck out. You get a meeting and you go in there. Well, guess what? Your meeting is going to be 15 minutes long. It's not going to be any longer. If it is longer, you're going to luck out because Bob lost track of time. To get to that level, you're probably going to end up pitching that thing to six of Bob's underlings, and it's one step up the rung to each step getting to Bob. Those development executives will sit down and have a meeting, and they'll talk about the pluses and minuses of what they think about your project, your reality TV series, before even Bob gets a chance to look at it. A couple of these development executives at the seminar that I went to, and they talked about, each one took, they said they took about an average of 5 pitches per day. So if that's not their only job, it's not like they go in and work at 9 o'clock and leave at 5, bring a bag lunch, and they take 5 pitches a day, and you break that up, and you're like, okay, well, hour and a half per pitch, your pitch is going to last no longer than 10 minutes, 15 minutes top. If you luck out and they're so interested in it, they'll sense it in the first 5 minutes. What they're going to do is they're going to say, do you have this? Do you have this? Do you have the rights? Is this set up? They're going to bang, 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 hit you up with these points. That specifically will narrow the field as to the people who are allowed to pitch these shows. And going back to listener email Mike W., I don't know what his station in life is. I don't know if, like I said, if he's a guy walking down the sidewalk or if he's a producer and he just doesn't know how to get a reality series pitched. The thing is that he's going to be hit on those points. If you haven't pitched those shows before, then you're never going to get one. You're never going to get heard, period. But you're not going to know what to say. And it could be a good idea. They may say, hey, fine, you know, don't call us, we'll call you. Or they may say, well, what if you change this and come back to us later and repitch it? As these development executives basically said, they took about an average of 5 pitches a day. I remember one of them saying that they took something like 15 pitches a day. And I thought, there's no way that person is taking 15 pitches a day. I think they were just sort of, you know, grandstanding to say, hey, I take 15 pitches a day. Well, this guy only takes 5. Well, I'm better off because I can spot him. I think he was just a lower rung development executive, and he was just the first line of defense at the door as people came in with pitches. So these development executives are seeing, I don't know, 25, 35 pitches a week, and you're talking about 10 to 15 minutes per pitch. of Mike W's and other people coming in and saying, I have this idea for a reality TV series. You're not going to be able to walk in and say, I have an idea. What do you think? Because they're going to say, well, where's your pitch reel? Where's your pitch book? And if you don't have it, thank you very much for playing and you're out the door. There's very rare exception to that, and I'll get to that towards the end of this. You aggregate that, your average development executive is going to see, I don't know, I did a thumbnail math, about 1,250 plus or minus 250 concepts, pitches a year. Are you telling me that there's over each development executive sees over 1,000 ideas in a year? Oh boy, absolutely. They're going to see so many ideas that they're going to go home and they don't even want to turn on the TV. In fact, I don't even think a lot of those people had TVs because they didn't want to go home and watch what they already did watch at work, or it was going home and they wanted to relax and do something else. Let's say, for instance, Mike is a producer and he's got this idea and he has a pitch reel put together and he just happens to have a pitch book put together. Who does he call? He wants to call Bob at NBC and he wants to get through those rung of six development executives before he gets to Bob, and he's willing to go the whole nine yards. Generally speaking, the way the pitches work is this, is that you're going to show up, according to these development executives and my personal experience, your office visits are going to be about 60-40. I thought it was half and half, but I think it was because I'm on one side of the fence and I can't see the other side of the fence, where these development executives, I pulled together their numbers and it averaged out about 60% of the pitches they get are personal meetings in the office where people, producers like Mike W., let's say he's a producer, come to them and pitch them the idea. And the other 40% are phone calls. So when we're talking about taking five pitches a day, maybe the guy who said he was taking 15 a day, maybe he took five a day and maybe he took seven, eight, nine, 10 on the phone real quick. You know, he talked for a half hour. Who knows? Every development executive I've ever spoken to has a phone surgically implanted on the side of their head. So I don't see how they could ever take a meeting. The more developed the pitch, the more likely it'll make it through to the next round. What do you mean the next round, Stan? Well, let me tell you, Stan. Like I said, let's say you're going to go pitch Bob at NBC, and you've got six people that you've got to go through. You're going to go through each development executive. You're going to go through a junior development executive, the next one up, and then it's going to get parsed up, and you could fail at any single time. Think of it as making the playoffs. You've got to play the season through, make the playoffs, and then win every single game in the playoff to get to the Super Bowl. And in the Super Bowl, you could still lose. That's essentially the way the pitch works. One of the development executives said something to the effect of that when they developed a concept to the point that it was ready for prime time, if you will, what they would do is once they developed it to the point, and when I say developed it, they're not doing anything but giving their feedback to, let's say, Mike W., the producer, and saying, you know what, I think you need to cut out this Honey Boo Boo chick because she is annoying, and put in someone else. And once you go cut that and come back and let's take a look at it, and it goes round and round and round, and you may spend 6 months, you may spend 7 months going back and forth, back and forth. You're not going to do it on one project. You're probably pitching five projects to them, and this happens to be one of them. But once these development executives, the general consensus that I could pull from it, because I tried to take, everybody had a different idea. Going back to the house analogy, think about a contractor. You know, you had a contractor and say, hey, how do you build a house? You're going to get 10 contractors. You're going to get 10 different ideas. They're all going to give you basically the same house, but they're going to give you different ideas of how to put it together. So the same thing with these development executives. And I tried to cobble together their answers to a point that would give you an idea of, you know, how they go about with the process. Here's the real disappointing part. As far as the pitches go, they all said that you had a 1 in 20 shot of seeing them, these development executives. And all of them had worked their way up from the rung. They had worked at the bottom rung, like let's say they were a Bob. I just made a Bob. I don't know Bob at NBC. Well, maybe I do know Bob at NBC. But they worked their way all the way up through the rung. So they were junior development executives and medium development executives to senior development executives. And they said that newbies, first-timers that come in the door, have a 1 in 20 shot of making it. You're thinking, wow, you know, is that that Dumb and Dumber question that Jim Carrey answered? Said, so I got a shot. If you're going to spend all that time and effort putting it together and you think, I got a 1 in 20 shot of anybody seeing me. I remember several times in my office, I'd be in the morning making coffee, and all of a sudden, someone walks up to the receptionist at the door, and they say, "Hey, Stan, somebody's here talking about a pitch reel." And I walk in, and I'm like, "Oh, hey, how you doing?" And next thing I know, within 30 seconds, I realize that they're not a client. They're just somebody who walked in off the street, did dialing for dollars, found our production company, knew that we produced pitch reels and did reality TV, and walked in and said, "Hey, I have this idea. I would like to pitch reality television." And then I would say, "Well, we're not necessarily the company that you would be looking for. You would want to look for the networks." Now, I would say 90% of that was true, and 10% was just a bald-faced lie, because I couldn't help the person out. I knew they just walked in off the street. There was nothing I was going to say or do to help them out. I had paying clients that we had work to have that needed to be done, and we had everybody, not standing around, but our production company was working on it, and I've got somebody who walks in off the street and wants to be able to pitch me a reality series. That's just not going to work. And when these development executives were asked about newbies coming in and pitching the ideas, and that I roughed it out to about 1 in 20, 1 in 25, I really got the impression that none of them have ever had a newbie walk in the door. It was just a feeling that I have, but what do you know? Let me depress you even more. This goes back to the, I thought it was a 50-50, 70-30 kind of thing. They generally said that the people that pitch them are, and I'm talking these development executives, usually the producers pitch them alone as about 60% of the time, and 40% of the time with agents. I sort of got the impression that about 70% of the time the agent would be with the producer and 30% they wouldn't, based upon my experience. I'm going to go with their numbers, even though I felt that it was a 70-30. Even if you split the baby, half and half, 50-50, half the time a producer's going in there alone and half the time with an agent. At the end of the day, if you're the producer, you've got to stand on both your feet and you have to pitch it to these development executives. And it's not going to be the only person. You're going to pitch and pitch and pitch. You may go around town a few times, and 6 months later, absolutely nobody's going to look at it, and you've run out of options. And what are you going to do? You're going to drop it and move on. Now, here's the thing. The positive side of that is that these agents and super producers are producing 40% of the work, and they're pitching about 40-50% of the work. And what do you mean by that? Look at, and I'm not going to use production companies' names as a sidebar. I was going to use companies as an example. I was going to say, well, this company produces this show, and it's been running for 5 years, and it's great, and this is what you want to do. I remember years ago, somebody asked me a question and came into my office, another one of those walking in off the street, and I let slip that I said, well, that's a show that is sort of like this company's show, so I'm not too sure, but don't take my word for it. You're going to have to do it on your own, and unfortunately, we're just not the right company for you. And I mean, I was being 90% honest with them. I didn't want to just, I realized that they had this dream or they were really pushing hard, and I can see that they were anxious and they wanted to get to somebody. We just weren't the people. So I didn't want to kick them out the door. And they said, okay, thank you. Well, 2 days later, I get this phone call from an executive at this production company who wants to talk to me. And I thought, oh, wow, man. Hey, we'd love to do some work with them. And the guy starts talking to me. He goes, yeah, you sent somebody over to my office to pitch some show. We don't know who this person is. I'm like, well, time. Who are you talking about? And they said this person's name. And I said, I don't know that person. This executive said, well, this person said they walked in and specifically spoke to you, and you said, go to us to pitch the show, came over here and sat in our lobby, and we almost had to get security to remove this person. Now, the person didn't look like, a crazy or anything like that. It was just someone who wanted to pitch an idea of a show, didn't know what the process was. And I said, listen, I can't even remember. We do so many shows here. I don't even remember who you're talking about. And then they described the person to me. And then I thought, oh, yeah, I remember that guy. I said, listen, there's got to be some mistake. We get people to walk in the door here all the time. In the first place, I would never tell somebody, go over to your production company because you do that show and you're going to get a chance to pitch there, because that's just not what we do. In fact, we want you to come to us so we can build your pitch reel so you can take it to the networks. You see how it goes? So I sort of had to talk this executive back from, you know, driving over and punching me out. I mean, this guy was hot under the collar. I'm thinking, what? And like I said, 95% of them, you know, will start yelling and want to get security. I think the guy just wanted to call and blow some steam off, and I talked him down and said, you know, I don't know who this person is. I don't know what you're talking about. And, you know, sorry, have a nice day, you know, and that was the end of the conversation. So that's my rule. I never use production companies or names of people, or I never name drop or, you know, say this production company does that, because I don't want some jerk off calling me on the phone and chewing my butt when I've got paying clients who are paying us to produce their pitch reels and shows. There are a lot of production companies out there that have first place. They have first dibs on these projects. So let's say they're a successful reality TV production company. And what I mean by successful is you turn on the TV, turn on network television, and watch some hit reality TV show, whether it's a competition show, whether it's a singing show, whether it's a performance show, or whether it's some other show, you name the idea, reality TV concept. Now, these production companies have produced several of these projects for, let's say, Bob at NBC. Well, guess what? These are the guys who can pick up the phone and go directly to Bob and say, hey, Bob, I've got this idea. What if we did this and did that? Bob would say, let's work on that. Let's run with it. Then they hang up the phone. They hire companies like my company, and we'll develop a pitch reel and put together a pitch book, and they turn around and go back. Now, some of these companies, these production companies, have their own in-house marketing and advertising arms specifically for pitching projects like that. And sometimes it's not even a formal department. They just do it themselves. And then Bob says, nah, I don't like that. And I go, okay, fine, because they're doing five other shows for them. Those are the guys and gals that get firsthand, they get first dibs, they're at the front of the line, they can pick up the phone and talk to a Bob at NBC or get things greenlit as far as putting together pitch reels. So for Mike W. talking about, hey, I have an idea and I want to pitch it for a reality TV show, I can tell you the first thing that you've got to do before anybody's even going to talk to you, because you can walk around Hollywood all you want and tell everybody your idea, I got this idea for a reality show. Sooner or later, somebody's going to steal that idea, and there's nothing you can do about it. What you have to do is you have to produce a pitch reel. Well, what is a pitch reel, Stan? Well, you know, think about these indie filmmakers that are producing these trailers for their feature films. They want to, say, raise money for a feature or proof of concept. Remember going back to the previous podcast where I talked about proof of concepts, trailers, things like that. They're going to put together a pitch reel, and the pitch reel is going to put their idea forward, and they're going to have a graphic novel. I'm not talking a big, giant Stephen King novel. I'm talking about a little comic book, if you will, laying out what they want to do. And there's an art to doing that. Just like there's an art to doing presentations in the business world, a PowerPoint art, people that are able to do those kinds of presentations that you don't fall asleep. Because I'll tell you one thing, if you don't grab them in the first 30 seconds, then they'll say, okay, whatever. If your pitch is 3 minutes long, they'll sit there and watch for 3 minutes, and they'll turn it off, ask you three questions, and then next thing you know, you're out the door. In a big, giant nutshell, that's essentially how a pitch makes it through the chain, you know, makes it up the chain to Bob. So let's recap. Let's help Mike out here. You know, let's sort of narrow this down for him. He wants to pitch a reality show. I don't know what it is. He didn't put it in his email. That's fine. I'm glad he didn't put it in his email, because I don't want to know. So helping Mike W. out, let's look at it this way. Who gets in the door? Well, Mike's not going to get in the door. He has a 1 in 20, 1 in 25 chance of seeing anybody. And these production companies have their own system. Listen, if I'm producing a hit reality TV show, say five of them, for one network, and or say two networks, then I'm going to be able to pick up the phone and call anybody I want in development over there and say, hey, I have this idea. What do you think? Let's run with this for a new show concept. You know, let's say their reality show got canceled and it's going to be up at the end of the year. They're going to try to fill that in with another opportunity. Mike's not going to get that chance. if Mike is lucky, he gets a 1 in 20, 1 in 25 chance of walking into a production company, sort of like the production companies I've worked for, and said, hey, I have this idea, and I want to hire you as a company to put together this pitch reel and this pitch book so that we can go pitch it to networks. So that goes back to who gets in the door. The thing is that established networkable companies, production companies and producers, the term that they like to use is super producers, okay, whatever. That's sort of the click term. The super producers get in the door. The super producers are the ones that are producing for the networks, the multiple reality TV shows, just not the one. Now, these development executives, they're going to see 5 to 10 to 15 pitches a day. So now Mike is up against 5 to 10 to 15 other people just in one day. At the end of the year, Mike is now up against 1,000, 1,200 other people, and that's just for that one development executive. That doesn't include the development executives above them. So if they're going to see, let's say one development executive, a junior one, sees 1,000 pitches a year, and by the time it gets whittled down and makes it up through the chain, maybe there's only 40. Now, if you're just a new producer off the street, and like I said, I don't know Mike's station in life, he's going to want to team up with a company that has a good track record. Well, how does he get in the door to see that company? He's not going to get in the door by making a phone call or even shotgunning them, like I've had people shotgun companies I've been in. What they're going to have to do, or what Mike's going to have to do, is he's going to have to get an agent. He's going to have to find an agent, and that'll take a long time. Hopefully lucks out in the first try and says, hey, I have a reality concept and I'd like an agent to help me go pitch it at this company. The agent's going to look at you and go, well, what else are you going to bring to the table for me? Because if that's all you have is one idea, I don't really want to bring you on as a client because I'm going to bust my butt to really make a little, if not have any chance of making any money off of this, trying to get you in to pitch your project. Unfortunately, that's just the way it is. That's the system it is. Nobody set the rules down. Like I said in the beginning, I told Mike he had absolutely positively no chance. Technically speaking, he has about a 1 in 20, 25 chance of getting in. But just having an idea that's not executed in any format whatsoever, there's no pitch reel, there's no script, there's no concept, there's no treatment, there's no pitch book, it's really tough. And I never tell anybody, never, ever, ever tell anybody you can't do it. You never know. There are people out there that were persistent and they have a good concept and are able to put it together. Who knows? Maybe they're able to put something together and get it seen. But if you're relying upon one concept, one show idea, and you think that's going to be your gold rush, the odds are so stacked against you. I'm not saying it can't happen. Like I said, he has a 1 in 20, 1 in 25 chance of seeing one development executive in Hollywood. Now, you got to find that development executive based upon this panel of development executives that I remember sitting in front of. Once you find that, do you make it to the next level? If you're going to make this a career and you want to be a producer and that's all you want to do is reality shows per se, you're going to have to come up with half dozen or so concepts and pitch reels. You get an agent, you tell the agent, hey, listen, I'm a producer, I'm an indie producer, I'm a solo, I'm a newbie, and I produce 6 concepts for reality shows. I've got pitch reels and books and all that. I'm looking for an agent that I would like to be able to take these and pitch to production companies or networks. And generally speaking, you're going to be pitching to the production companies, the super producers first, before you even get to the network level. You may get to the network level, you're going to be talking to a junior producer, or a junior producer, you're going to be talking to a junior executive that in development that is just going to sit there and nod their head, and they're going to say, they're not going to say yay or nay because they don't have the power to. All they do is take in your information and move it up through the chain when they have development meetings in those companies. Let's say Mike happens to find an agent and the agent says, okay, well, why don't you send me along what you got? Let me take a look at it. If the agent isn't a reality TV agent or doesn't work in that realm, and agents work in so many different realms and they have so many different skills and abilities, that they may turn around and say, nah, I don't see it. Well, you know, keep trying. Find an agent. Find another agent. You know, keep moving. I know it's a long, drawn-out explanation, but there is no simple, short answer. I'm sorry to say, but that's just the way the rules are. I don't make the rules. The rules got cobbled together over the years as reality TV started to come to life in this realm, from, you know, cops TV show to the actor strike, and it's cheaper for networks to produce reality TV. In fact, some of the show budgets I've seen, I don't understand how they can get those shows produced on those budgets. And I'm talking about the lower end, the first year, first season kinds of reality shows. For Mike, my best advice to you is, if you have the one idea and you don't have a pitch reel and you don't have a graphic novel, a pitch book to go with it, then all you have is an idea and you can't do anything with it. You can walk around with that idea in your pocket for the rest of your life, and it may be the best idea that reality TV has ever seen. But unless you're able to partner up with a producer or an agent and get it done, and when I say get it done, meaning a pitch reel and a pitch book, it's going to be tough to get that concept and that idea and to be able to get that pitch meeting. I'm not saying don't do it. That's where you're going to have to start off. First thing, start off with your treatment, your concept, your idea, reduce it to writing, form it together. I don't know what kind of skill level Mike is at. If he's, like I said, whether he walks off the street or if he's an up-and-coming producer, or maybe he's a producer of documentaries and he wants to go into reality TV. Get your pitch reel, get your pitch book, start looking for an agent and go that route. That's the best advice I can give based upon just that one question. And the only reason I took that one email was because I get that all the time. So hang in there, Mike. That's the best advice I can give you. It's the best advice I can give other aspiring producers and people who want to produce reality TV. Book recommendation, real quick. The Independent Film and Video Maker's Guide by Michael Weiss Productions. It's a cool little book. It runs you around $30 or less. You can find it on Amazon. I'll have the link on the website for the book, The Independent Film and Video Maker's Guide. And for my software recommendation, the Final Draft Reader. It's a new app that just came out. They have it on the iPhone and the iPad. I understand that they're trying to get a mobile version out for Android. I don't know when that's going to happen. If you're in the iPhone ecosystem, the iPad ecosystem, Final Draft Reader is the bomb. You can use it with your Final Draft script writing program. Save your script to, say, the cloud. Let's say Dropbox is what I use. I save my scripts to the cloud in Dropbox. Then when I'm out on the town, you know, I'm hanging out in the backyard or something like that, and I want to be able to read the script for a few minutes or whatever, I pull it down through the cloud onto my iPhone, make notes, and you can make notes and then turn around and pull that back down off the cloud. It's so cool. I highly recommend it. The iPhone iPad app for Final Draft, the Final Draft Reader. Well, everybody, thanks for joining me on the Hollywood South Blacklist, where we've tried to discuss all things Hollywood South, a filmmaker's paradise. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, send us an email to podcast@thehollywoodsouthblog.com. And be sure to stop by the website, take a look around. We'll have all the show notes and links we discussed on the show. This is Stan Gill for the Hollywood South Blacklist. Thanks for listening.